Take your seats so that we can get started with the next session. Please take your seats. Thank you.
Yeah, after all these years in academia, I still haven't figured out what you have to say.
Oh, I don't know.
Next time.
That
when you apply to the full
November.
Okay, we're going to get started with the next session in light of the timing issues. Please take your seats, and since it's a crowded room, we have to have some quiet. Please take your seats. Thank you. Thank you to the afternoon, or to the second session in the morning. My name is Tim Geary. I'm at the Institute of Parasitology. I'm very, very pleased today to introduce Richard Gold. Richard is a lawyer, which is a good thing. The best thing about Richard is his degrees from the University of Michigan, where I actually spent time. So that means he has credibility immediately. Richard is a tremendous addition to this program. He is the founding director of the Center for Intellectual Property Policy here at McGill, so this is a perfect complement to what we're talking about. Recently, he became the president of a very interesting not-for-profit organization called the Innovation Partnership, which is really a consultancy for international development, and it's a very clever and opportune time to develop this kind of an organization. He has a tremendous reputation in the field. He's very widely sought, both nationally and internationally, for advice and consultation on issues relating to development and intellectual property. And I would welcome him to this session today. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for that introduction. I'll try to live up to it. And thank you for listening to a lawyer. Am I the only one in the room? Okay, well, I'll try and resuscitate our image. I want to talk to you about some of the practical programs that we have engaged in. As Tim just mentioned, we set up the Innovation Partnership about 2 years ago to try to look at issues chiefly of development and the use of innovation, partly in the health, or primarily in the healthcare field, but also in other areas of technology. What I'll do is, we had a 7-year study that ended last September, so I'm going to talk very briefly about it and then really tie that into the programs we did. So one of the questions just before the break was, how do you translate your research into actual programs? And that's what we attempt to do through the Innovation Partnership, which is based on the 7 years of research we've done on biotech IP and try the lessons we learned from that, how do we apply that in practice? So that's really what my talk is about. I'm going to go through the introductory slides quickly because I assume most people know that in terms of, you know, the points up there. The problem of actually finding medicines, whether for developed or developing countries, but particularly questions over access in developing countries to not only HIV/AIDS medications and vaccines, but to disease, other disease drugs. And as you probably also know, intellectual property is not usually seen in the best of lights, especially since 1998, where 39 pharmaceutical companies sued the government of South Africa for having basically implemented changes to their intellectual property regime that would allow them to sell more inexpensive drugs against HIV/AIDS. And that raised all kinds of controversies, and there are other controversies, too, that I won't go into now. Particularly for developing countries, because that's where I'm going to concentrate today, there have been concerns over the imposition of Western-style intellectual property, particularly patents, trade secrets, data protection, all the legal tools used by pharmaceutical companies to protect their innovation, their drugs, here, but also has effects in developing countries. What we found out in terms of our research was that there are several problems that we thought we could address. First of all, we kept hearing stories, whether in Canada's north, this is not just a north-south issue, it's also within Canada, or elsewhere, stories of researchers who go into communities, particularly traditional communities, do research using their knowledge, talking to their elders, and then leaving, and no one knows what the results of the research is. And so there are some complaints about the fact that you did research on us, but we don't actually know what the findings were. Also, we found that in talking to institutions within developing countries, so universities and public research institutions, they actually thought that, and they do a significant amount of innovation, they thought that they can commercialize it and make a lot of money. Their image of what Western universities do was exactly that, selling their innovation to industry and making money. It doesn't happen here. Most universities actually either break even or lose money. And it's even less likely to happen in developing countries. So there are a lot of misconceptions about intellectual property. And not only is it the universities and the public institutions that believe that, but often traditional communities feel that they can make a lot of money, or they ought to make a lot of money from sharing their traditional knowledge that might eventually, many years later, lead to medicine. It's also unlikely to ever happen. So what we did is in our study is we tried to examine a whole lot of questions, including the ones I just talked about, and I won't take you through it completely. As you can see, a whole variety of methodologies, including empirical collection of empirical data, case studies, discussions with thought leaders throughout the world, workshops where we validated our work, etc. And we identified out of this research six overarching themes. Yeah. Okay, and the two in bold are the ones I'm going to talk to you about today. So trust and building and maintaining scientific infrastructures, because the two programs I'm going to talk about tie into that. The other themes are better communications, just that people who don't actually know what other people are doing and thinking. The importance of collaborations, both between North and South, but even between public and private sector, and the nature of those collaborations are important. I won't be talking about that now. And there's a large knowledge gap. We actually don't know how innovation happens, who's doing it, how they transfer it, and the role of things like patents in it. And so it's very important to collect that type of information. And then as we roll out programs, we need to measure our success based on something. We don't have very good measures of success. So if we want to know, are we actually achieving goals in terms of providing innovative products and assisting indigenous populations, we don't have those tools, so those need to be developed. Let me just touch on the two themes that I highlighted. One of the overriding conclusions we reached, this is probably not surprising to anybody, is the lack of trust. Lack of trust between public and private sector, sometimes within government, certainly between indigenous populations and their governments who are charged through international treaties with taking care of them. So international law says it's the role of the state to protect the genetic resources upon which indigenous populations live, and many of them just completely fail to do so. Through our case studies, we found an example of over-bureaucratization, if that's a word, of the protection of indigenous populations, where the administrative procedures were so heavy that researchers couldn't actually conduct research with a traditional community in Brazil, the Kraho people, because the administrative load was too heavy, and to the loss of both the researchers and the communities who wanted to share their knowledge, they were unable to do so. And I have many other examples of lack of trust, including Canada's attempt to deliver medicines to developing countries, a regime we brought in 5 years ago. We're celebrating its fifth anniversary this month, which has been not a total failure, but almost total failure. One of the recommendations we came up with then, and this is where it comes into our program, is that we didn't feel governments had the trust enough of people around the world to actually build trust, that we needed independent organizations that could talk to industry, NGOs, indigenous peoples, to be able to start a dialogue. And the first part of starting the dialogue is to transfer knowledge, both tacit and explicit. And so one example of what we did, we actually funded this out of our own money, because in fact, to our surprise, there's very little money for capacity building in this area, so we actually had to find, we used our own money to do this. We worked with the Man people in Guatemala. It's about, in Huehuetenango is about 7 hours outside the capital. It's a community that has a hospital. There's a community organization that fights for human rights. They run the clinic. It's not a hospital. They run the clinic. And the entire community is involved with it. They use some plants from the region that they actually use in the community. And they think that some of these plants may have medicinal effects. And through a very long process of just building a relationship with them, just talking to them about their needs, they're very reticent. The lack of trust was obvious right from the beginning. We needed to just tell them what we do, and we had to listen to them. We had to understand where they were coming from. And through that, we actually built a program. We sent down two people to this city, this village, to train the entire community, people with almost no education all the way to people with a basic legal education about intellectual property, how they might want to think about sharing the knowledge they have in the plants, because they're interested in validating this feeling that these plants actually do something. They actually do want to share it, but they're completely afraid that some company is going to come in, patent it, and leave them out in the cold, not even give them credit. And so our goal here was just to listen to what they wanted to learn about and enter into a dialogue with the entire community. And so we started from the ground up. We really went to the community and said, look, this is the type of thing we know about. What is it you want to know? Why is this important to you? And so we try to be, no one can be completely neutral, but we try to be as neutral as possible and respond to their needs rather than have a preset program as many international organizations do. They say, okay, you want to learn about patent law? Here it is. And they just give it. We started the other way. We said, what do you want to do? And let's tailor the course together so that it would achieve that. And the training program included, as I said, everybody from the farmers who worked in this village all the way to the people who were the organization's leadership. And they made the decision. They didn't, you know, we had said, do you want us to offer one course to the community and a different, more advanced course to the leadership? And they said, no, we want to do this all together. So we tailored the course to them. And the result was that they've asked us to go back and do a second course, a more advanced course, and we're looking for the money to do so. And so they're now opening up to us. We have at the beginning, we didn't even know what kind of plants they were talking about. They wouldn't even tell us that. But after building this relationship, we have more understanding of where they're coming from and what their needs are. One of our goals, if we have a number of these communities, is actually to hook them up and create networks of communities with similar type concerns so that not only do they learn from us, they can learn from each other, and obviously we learn from listening to all of them. The second point that I want to talk about is the need to develop a scientific infrastructure. So the first point was really about trust, about dealing with very local communities who feel marginalized, and as you probably know, in Guatemala, indigenous populations often feel marginalized. But the second one is really dealing with the researchers. There is a significant amount of scientific capacity in many developing countries, obviously not all at the same level. Not all of it is at, you know, what we would, the type of standards we impose on ourselves, but much of it is very advanced, and almost all of it is targeted to the particular needs of the countries and regions involved. A lot of that research goes nowhere. The institutions don't get patents because they feel, well, why bother? If someone's going to infringe it in the United States or Canada, I don't have the resources to sue them, so why bother even getting a patent? They don't have any access to the money that they would need to take that knowledge further in order to actually deliver it to people in their own countries. And, of course, there are other problems that that different developing countries face, such as a brain drain, such simple things as having high-speed internet access. So all that scientific material we're now requiring to be freely available. Well, if you can't download it, it's not terribly available to you. So there are a whole bunch of things. But one of the missing ingredients, and the one that we felt we competent to talk about, was that of intellectual property and how that should be used within innovation systems. So again, we had a recommendation. This is in the end of our research that came out in September 2008, that we should also have capacity building directed to those who are engaged in science and technology transfer in low and middle income countries. And so in June of 2007, all the way through August, we put on a program in Eastern Africa aimed at chiefly scientists, although we had some participants from the patent office in Kenya, with about 25 participants. And what we did is we tried to, the first thing again we did is find local partners. So we partnered with the University of Nairobi, with in a couple of research centers located in Nairobi, and we asked them again, what is it you want to know? And one of my PhD students actually had worked there for a long time. We also invited a researcher from the University of Nairobi to come spend time with us. So together we were able to craft a course that we thought responded to the particular needs of the scientists in these institutions. And what we decided to provide training on collectively was providing a basic understanding to scientists of what intellectual property was, patents and so on, how that would apply in their own labs in terms of keeping notes, in terms of dealing with graduate students and so on, basic licensing notions, how do you deal, if you get a patent, well, what's the process of getting a patent, how do you license it, why might you want to license it one way rather than another, what about things like revenue, open access, et cetera. So we gave them about a two-week intensive course, and then what we did is we asked them to go back to their institutions and do an audit of the IP policies at those institutions. Many of those institutions had no IP policy. Others had IP policies that were dysfunctional. One of the interesting things about this is that the students came back and presented their audits and we critiqued it, one of the interesting outcomes was that the people we trained, when they finished the course, were asked by their institutions to actually either develop an IP policy from scratch, revise the existing IP policy, and in one case, to actually set up a technology transfer office, which in some ways made us feel very happy that we had trained them. It also scared us because we hadn't provided all that much training, and it shows just the need for knowledge in this area. If the people who took our course had the most knowledge in the institution to set up a technology transfer office, that means there's a continuing need for it. In fact, the people who did set up the technology transfer office have come back to us and asked us to provide a second level of training. Again, we're searching for funds to do so. I think I'm within my time limit. That's quite unusual for me. And I'm a lawyer. That's even more unusual. So what did we learn from these experiences? First, there is a knowledge deficit. So we feel that we are fulfilling a need in countries, both among the scientific community. And it took us, I mentioned before the fact that that institutions thought they could make money off of intellectual property. We had to repeat this for 2 days. Before they actually believed us, because we had someone who came down from the World Intellectual Property Office, who are the evangelists for patent rights. And after hearing from him, they thought, well, we're going to make a fortune. And they said, you know, Oxford makes money and Harvard makes money. And we had said, that's the exception, not the rule. So we saw that there was a definite need, and the response was positive, both among indigenous peoples and researchers. But we think the most important thing is that we started from the ground up, that we didn't go in with prior conceptions of what these communities needed to be trained on. So we completely broke the rule that usually happens either by universities who invite researchers to the United States or Canada or Europe to take a program that they have pre-selected. We did the opposite. We went to them, which reduces costs. But it also allows us to adapt it. The second thing we did is we made sure at every step to involve the local leadership. When we left, we were not sure we would be able to find funding for future programs, and we didn't want it to die out. And so what we tried to do is use as many local experts as possible who were probably just down the street from the people we were training, but they didn't know each other. And so we were able, through the course, to facilitate the creation of networks, or at least the development of existing networks in these regions. And we feel that that's very important, that the program ought to continue whether or not we are able to continue. To build trust, again, I think it's critical that you start from their needs and not ours. So you ask them what it is you want to be trained on. And through that, we actually feel that we have developed the trust of these communities enough, at least, for them to ask us to come back. So thank you.